Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Save $100 on the Craftsman V20 6-Tool Power Tool Combo Kit, now at $199. No matter what the project is, Craftsman's high-quality, high-performance products empower you to build on. Stop by your nearest Lowe's store and check out the full line of Craftsman tools today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Hi, folks. How you doing? How was your week? I hope you had a good one. I had a very busy one, and I've got a very busy one ahead of me. But last week, we held a Soundtrack and Everyman Film Club event with a preview of John McLean's new film, Tornado. It's wonderful. It's been 10 years since Slow West, so, I mean, we've been waiting a long time for this. And I've been desperately trying to get John on the podcast, and I don't know why that's not happened, but needless to say, we had a lovely record on Friday night at Everyman Broadgate, and I'm very excited to bring that conversation to you, because it also included Jack Loudon, who, bless him, he's in the middle of a run doing a play called Fifth Step with the wonderful Martin Freeman, which I'm going to see this week, actually, at Soho Place. And it's quite a short theatre production. It's 90 minutes. So Jack literally came off stage, pegged it to join us for most of the conversation, actually. So I'm really, really looking forward to sharing that with you. And just keep an eye out for Tornado being on at cinemas near you, because you really should see it on the big screen. The only thing I'm going to say about it is it's a kind of Scottish samurai western. It's great. But anyway, I am so excited about today's episode, because we are taking a deep dive into the world of Twin Peaks today with music editor Laurie Eschler, who worked on the original series, and longtime David Lynch collaborator Dean Hurley, who did all kinds of work with him on, well, numerous projects. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this conversation. For me, this really kind of is what this podcast was set up for, to be able to dive into. It doesn't always have to be a new release. And I'm so grateful to the MUBI team for reaching out and getting in touch to ask if I'd be able to do anything ahead of Twin Peaks, the first two seasons and the film being available on MUBI's streaming platform. So thank you so, so much, Team MUBI. It was just the most fascinating conversation. And before that, I wanted to make sure that I point you in the direction of our YouTube channel, actually, Soundtrack and Extra, because over the next couple of weeks, because we are so busy at the minute, some of our conversations are going to sit up there as exclusives. So the full conversations won't be on the podcast, but you can head to YouTube to listen to the conversations in full. Loads of extra content up there. Among those exclusive interviews are with Michael Patrick King, pretty much the driving force behind another seminal TV show, Sex and the City. Here's a little taster.
I mean, what's so great about the show for people who watch it is there's so many varieties of strong, interesting, complicated, flawed, heroic, tragic women that you can sit at home and watch, and just like that, there are five very strong, vibrant women. Mm-hmm. And they're all going through their 50s the way they go through their 50s. And it's nice, because when you were 34, you were watching these four characters struggle, and now you're, I don't know what your age you are. We have 20-year-olds watching the 30-year-olds in Sex and the City now. We have 30-year-olds watching the 50-year-olds. It's this kind of great dance back and forth between what the world is presenting women with and how they're dealing with it.
Michael Patrick King, writer and director of Sex and the City and Just Like That, which is now streaming. The new season is up on Sky TV here in the UK and HBO Max around the world, in an interview that you can watch in full on our YouTube channel. And so let's get to Laurie and Dean, who join us to discuss the original Twin Peaks and the return. And where else can we begin but with that iconic theme?
Thank you.
Listen, I won't keep you longer than I need to because I'm so appreciative of your time today. And what's been so nice, actually, in preparation for this being made available to people to watch again on Mubi is going back in. Going back almost reminds you of that first experience you had of watching the show, you know, of where you were, how it made you feel, what it made you think about. And yeah, not many things do that, I think, you know, in terms of it also have that longevity. So I'm excited to celebrate it. I guess that's a nice place to start, to be honest, is how it feels for you both to have been part of Twin Peaks and to still see how it resonates, still see how new generations of, you know, fans of storytelling are maybe coming to it for the first time or are revisiting it.
What I've noticed most is that our culture has evolved since Twin Peaks was first aired. It has become a much different experience, I think, and almost a different story than what people experienced in 1989 or 90. I just remember people interpreting it in 1990 and kind of not having the tools and understanding and insight that most people have now in our culture.
For me, I was probably in elementary, first year middle school when the original series came out. I mean, I didn't watch it back then when it aired. I missed that whole wave. But just the fact when I started working for David and then being involved in The Return and stepping into that echelon over like huge decades of time, it just felt like wow, like this is a Halley's Comet moment of like, when is this, you know? And of course, now that he's passed, it's like these things happen and they align and then they dissipate. And it's like, wow, I was there. I saw it happen. You know, it was so cool. And I got to learn about Lori through, you know, starting that job at David and looking through the archive and seeing her name on things. And that I became aware of her and pieced together, you know, what she was doing. And it was kind of mind blowing because, you know, it's very much behind the curtain work, you know, that we do. And not many people knew about it. And this is the first time I'm talking with Lori on like a Zoom like this, you know, so it's really cool.
How did you come to be part of working with David on Twin Peaks? What was that journey to be part of that team?
He had been looking for music editor and he'd been interviewing music editors, and he didn't make any connections. And it was a television show, so, you know, they're bringing in TV music editors from that era. And I don't know what his experience was, but I know he was not satisfied. And he asked John Huck, his production sound recordist, to do the music editing. And John is a friend of mine who I had worked with quite a bit and known. And he said, well, I don't edit music, but I know somebody who does. And so he referred me and they called me and I met with David.
Where did you meet with him at?
At Todd AO, the old building. That's where the cutting rooms were. And Dwayne was there. And David and I got into kind of a metaphorical discussion about the music and how to work with it. And I understood what he was talking about. So we kind of bonded. Plus, we're both from Montana. So we were talking about Montana. And, you know, after about 30 minutes, he said, well, you better get started.
Wow. Just like that.
Yeah, I was 4 feet off the ground. I was so excited.
Where was the show at that point?
They were editing. They had finished the pilot, I believe. Maybe they were still working on it. They had been shooting the episodes. So, I mean, I started pretty much the next month, the following Monday. It was a Friday, I believe. And I had an editing room, like just downstairs from Dwayne's editing room. And then they moved me upstairs across the hall from Dwayne. And yeah.
89, right?
In 89.
89 was a huge year for David. Like in talking to Scott Ryan and looking back at the timetable, and I tried to write out like what was going on around this time and looking at all the tape labels of like Julie's album and everything, you see that he's recording Floating Into the Night in January of 1989. He's then shooting the Twin Peaks pilot in February. He's then shooting Wild at Heart in August. He's doing the Industrial Symphony in like October or something like that. And then he's mixing Wild at Heart at the end of 89. So it's like that year is just so crazy with the creative sort of output that's going on and how he's like multitasking. It's wild.
Yeah, it was a pretty tight ship because he was never missing. I think he just kept everything really centralized.
Yeah.
And I know that he went to New York a lot, but he was always in the editing room. And
yeah, Duane was handling both of those projects.
I guess it's about building up trust with your collaborators as well, you know, in terms of yes, being on the same page, but also having that trust that you have the ability to throw ideas in or to have your own ideas that you can give him that he'll, you know, and he'll listen to.
Absolutely. And I think that's why it took him a while to find a music editor as well as other people on the team. He hired some people who were open, people who didn't have like this preconceived notion of how it should be done. TV back then was sort of like the Detroit auto industry. It was built for efficiency and no experimentation. Everybody I worked with in editorial and audio, the mixers were really great, really open. The picture editors were really willing to experiment. People were stumbling into these wonderful mistakes and making the most of them. And so, yeah, it was quite different from normal television production and post-production.
Dean, what about you? How did you come to start working with David?
It was kind of similar. And hearing Lori's experience, it reminds me a lot of like the fact that David like cast his post personnel similar to how he cast the movie. He just kind of sat across the table from him and got a vibe. And I think the whole time in his mind, he's like, is this person going to be on the level? Am I going to be able to like shoot the shit with him and be comfortable? And but yeah, for me, it was the same way. It was like he had a studio in the Hollywood Hills that he built after filming Lost Highway. And the Lost Highway was shot in this house. And then he gutted it and made a mixed stage recording studio out of it. And it was so immense and sort of done properly that he needed to have a full-time engineer. And so he had an engineer for a number of years. And then they parted ways. And he asked a friend of his, hey, I need a new engineer. And so the friend sent up some candidates. I just remember having a cold interview with them. And I mean, I was 25 at the time. I probably looked 13. And in retrospect, you know, just going back and thinking about these like life situations where you just are plopped into a meeting, he had no business hiring me for that job. You know, like, I think the job was pitched to me as a recording studio engineer. And I'm like, I'm not really trained in that, you know, that kind of thing. But he showed me the studio and he was just like, you know how to work all this? And I was like, yeah, sure. You know, and then the first week I got the job, I was like, oh God. Like, he's like, let's get to work. And I was like, let me figure out how this room is wired. You know, it was wild. But yeah, and the same thing with Lori about the Montana connection. I always had heard that as his bio, like born Missoula, Montana, Eagle Scout. And that's all I knew about his bio. And he was like, well, where'd you grow up? And I said, Virginia. And he was like, oh, I grew up in Virginia. Like, I spent my formative high school years there. And I was like, really? And talking, like he had a son who lived 20 minutes from where I grew up. And his wife, Mary Fisk, you know, his ex-wife still lived there on a farm, Jack Fisk's sister. Like, and I realized, like in the 80s, when I was a young kid, David was living 20 minutes from me. I had no idea.
Wow.
Odd synchronicities like that, you know?
Oh, yeah.
He probably felt it. You know, that idea where you're like, he's sort of feeling a vibe. It's like, I totally believe in that. There's a kind of physical presence with people in a room, isn't there, that you can kind of really... It works or it doesn't it? You can kind of, there's a reason for it, for sure.
And I've heard him say later, like when we were hiring production sound recordists for The Return, I remember he took some meetings with people and I wasn't in the meeting and I was like, well, what'd you feel? Because he wanted, like the same thing with the John Huck thing where he's like, he wanted John Huck to do it. early on, he would make me record production sound. And I'm like, I do not want to do this. I don't know what I'm doing. So when Twin Peaks Return started coming around, he was like, well, I guess you're recording production sound. And I'm like, I am not doing that. Like, I do not like that job. It's incredibly hard. There are people who know what to do that have tools. And so he was recording or interviewing production sound recorders. And I was like, how'd you like so-and-so? And he's like, yeah, he was good. But, you know, it's like, I wouldn't want to have a cup of coffee with him. You know what I mean? Like, I think it was important for him to have a rapport with somebody and be able to talk and, you know.
Well, it's interesting what you're saying there about him kind of encouraging you to do other elements around, I guess, what you're...
It wasn't encouraging. It was more like, and I noticed this watching documentaries about Kubrick, it's that, back to that trusted circle you mentioned. He gets this trusted circle and he just starts relying on people to do more than they were brought on to do, because he doesn't want to widen his circle of craftsmen. He just like sound, okay, you can do that, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's sort of similar to how I heard like Leon Vitelli working with Kubrick, because he just kept getting more and more responsibility over the years, you know?
Yeah, totally. Because I think, you know, Laurie, when you look back at kind of, you know, the first two seasons to start with of Twin Peaks, saying that you were a music editor really undersells what you did on those shows, you know, in terms of how important you were to how that show made us feel. You know, that's the kind of the beauty of music. It's part of the storytelling. It's a character. And I think within Twin Peaks, it's more than one character. You know, it's kind of, that's the brilliant thing about it. I get, what was the starting point for you? Because, you know, the music, Angelo, obviously, all this incredible music that he was or had composed by that point. Talk to me a little bit about the kind of conversations that you were having about sculpting, you know, that music and what you had to do to it. It wasn't just a case of placing it. I think people will listen to this, will go, oh, what's a music editor? You know, some people will be thinking, well, that is. And I think just saying that's what you did really undersells how much you did on the show.
The way that we treated the music was completely different from the, you know, traditional method of scoring music for film or television. So they pre-recorded all the music and handed it to me, and I organized it. The first season I was working on 35 millimeter mag, which is cumbersome, very cumbersome. And so I had a great assistant who was super organized, and she, part of what I did was I would take like a phrase of the music and loop it and physically make a loop. And then she would take it over to the dubbing facility across the street and get me like 1,000 feet of that so that I would have that to use. And that's how a lot of those, we called them mystery loops back then. There are lots of names for them.
The quintessential like stair music that like when it's always like the shot of the overhead fan, and it's like that plotting, like rom 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 rom.
Yeah,
that's that slowed down New York PSA. That,
right? Yeah, the Rat PSA.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I just discovered that recently. But like, there's all these crazy nuggets where he would steal something that he used prior, and then, like Laurie was saying, make a loop of it, and it became a whole nother piece of music.
Like, I had the solo tracks from all of the stuff they recorded in New York. So the jazz saxophone, for example, I eventually slowed that down and layered it over some of the dark mystery loops to create other things. And then I, you know, started doing more backwards tracking and playing with that. It became much easier the second season because I was working with a digital audio workstation that really sped up the process. So I was able to be a lot more experimental and, you know, try things more quickly, determine if something worked or if I should put it to the side and use it later. But it was like a completely different experience the second season.
I mean, I've heard you elegantly describe you learned the sort of his musical language or like the language of the show. How long did, like looking back, do you think you kind of dialed in? Or like, what was the point you started to get comfortable where you could grab whatever?
Oh, well, the first few episodes, he worked closely with me and we would talk about different ideas. And I always felt really comfortable to try things and show them to him. If there was something not working, he would be really clear at communicating how to adjust it or what, you know, how it was different from what he wanted. I mean, we kind of were developing the language together. You know, I would make a discovery and go, oh, this is cool. And so I'd play it for him. And, you know, he would then have it in his encyclopedia for later use as well. And so that's how we built kind of the library of kind of the alternative music of Twin Peaks, the stuff that was manufactured using the pre-existing music. And we kept developing the language up through Fire Walk With Me, and to a point where we didn't really use words anymore. It was when we were doing the final mix of Fire Walk With Me, it was just eye contact and, you know, a funny look or something. And we just understood each other. It was a great experience creatively. And it affected the way I look at everything.
What did Angelo write too? Was it script?
I mean, sometimes he would see the episode, but when he worked with David, David would more describe a mood and the location. And he worked with the musicians that way. There was never any playback going on. They weren't scoring to picture. They were creating, you know,
atmosphere, mood,
and themes. You know, the themes were developed early on and used for the first two seasons. And, you know, they would develop new themes as well as needed. He was really good at getting performances and improvisation from the musicians.
And going back through, like, sort of archival material, I kind of found like a original cassette that had all the main themes of, like, I guess the moods, if you will, of like the placeholders of, like, they call it fast, cool jazz, slow, cool jazz, you know, the Laura Palmer's theme. And they were all done on Piano Rhodes.
Yeah, they kind of sketched out the music on the Rhodes piano.
It was all Piano Rhodes, so that was all like demos, and it's like they had that of like, okay, here are the set pieces, the tableaus of the musical characters, and then they went to like Art Palumbis's studio in near Times Square and recorded all that stuff, and then it was like delivered to Lori or the production as every iteration, like they'd make songs essentially, and then every song had, you know, the drum stem, just brush drums, just saxophone, just, and then alternate mixes of like this plus this, this plus this. And it was such a huge configuration. It was almost like a color palette of, okay, we want this, but like not the full cue, like something a little more simplified that just, you know, touches, you know, the theme, or just, you know, squirts a little bit of the callback. And Lori was in that seat of sort of picking and choosing of like, yeah, got it, we could do this here, but this, you know, what I'm imagining that was going on in your mind and how you were collaging all this stuff, essentially.
Yeah, it was really helpful to have the stems and, you know, each instrument separated, because, you know, we'd be using a theme, but there would be something conflicting or too busy or, you know, conflicting with something in the sound effects. So it was just great. Like, I'll strip that out, or I'll just, a lot of times I would just find one or two instruments to lay in with, you know, into whatever piece I was putting together, like a collage. It really gave us a lot of power to carve out whatever sort of aspect of the scene was most important, so that you didn't have this big heavy music cue, you know, squashing everything.
To give an example of that, Lori, like on the soundtrack, for instance, like that original season one soundtrack, that track The Bookhouse Boys is where it kind of is like a montage of several things. Is that kind of like your editorial creation in that sense of like you combine that, do you think?
I'm not sure what they used to put the soundtrack together. It was done that summer during hiatus. I was in Indonesia. So I got
Well deserved holiday.
Yeah. they had this beautiful thing finished, the CD, and I wasn't a part of putting that together, and I don't know that they accessed the stems from the actual episodes to get anything that I had done. I kind of don't think so.
It's a good example, though, of the type of thing that was the sort of result of Lori's work, because you hear several different songs and they sort of cascade and bleed into each other. And that is like sort of what I am envisioning happened a lot on the series of these, you know, the musical collage. And I think there's something really, really cool and magical that happens in that kind of scoring approach, as opposed to, you know, someone sitting down and doing something straight to picture. There's almost something like more complex than any one person making a significant change, because you're dealing with, I just love collage. And I think that not a lot of things are made in this way, you know?
Yeah. And the power of that is the ability to subtract. It was a great tool because everything was happening together when we would bring the sound effects, the dialogue, you know, the Foley, the music together. We were able to say, we don't really need that. Pull it out. And in that sense, the collage, you know, we were able to make negative space for something else to sort of peek through.
I also love the idea of the perspective of some of the music, you know, and the development of themes and where they are and how important they are in the storytelling in terms of where that character is or where that relationship is or whose perspective are we seeing this from, you know. And I think that, you know, that theme tune is so iconic. And I was reading something, Lori, where you were talking about it, and the idea that Laura's theme is really about how everybody else in the town felt about her, whereas you look at the theme from Far Walk With Me and it's Laura from her perspective. And I love that idea that as the show and the story progresses, we get these kind of different perspectives through the music, which is so clever.
Yeah, it was great that they developed that theme for Fire Walk With Me. Scott Ryan, who wrote a book about it, the music of Twin Peaks, pointed out that, you know, that was really about what Laura was going through. And it had a saxophone in it, but it was not playful or anything like that. It was great in that it brought out her suffering. So that was really powerful in Fire Walk With Me, because that's what the movie was about. I mean, that was sort of the primary focus of the film.
Thank you.
But yeah, it was really fun to develop things with, like, you know, the first time Audrey meets Cooper, and, you know, there's that fun jazz piece there. And,
yeah,
you know, this, the vibes work best for in this sort of scenario, whereas saxophone in this, or there were cues with alto flute that were gorgeous. That was fun. And that by itself, when slowed down, became a completely different animal, the alto flute playing any of the themes.
Yeah. It's almost been recomposed in a way, isn't it? And that idea that this music's been written, you've got all these ingredients and you're kind of making a new dish from them in a way, in terms of what suits whilst you're editing the episodes or together. It's so incredible to hear the manipulation that was there and the combinations and the reconfiguring that was, it's extraordinary.
It was kind of cool that the music started becoming more complex as the episodes went by and developed into deeper and darker themes, which is how the storyline was as well. It starts out as a murder mystery, and then it starts becoming way more than that. And the music started becoming more than that, more complex. And there were so many opportunities to just sort of foreshadow and find context that wasn't really coming out, and sort of bringing it out a little bit by accenting it.
One of the really key core components, I think, to how David and Angelo did music post Blue Velvet, because Blue Velvet was done in kind of the traditional scoring way, is this fact that, but this kept on going throughout the rest of their partnership in films down the line, is the fact that they would go in and dabble and find the sounds in the key songs of the thing, and then David would be going into production with all that floating in his mind. So he knows the sonic palette, and he's looking at the camera and the scenes and everything, and with all that music running through his mind. So there's that kind of game of memory playing, but you know, it doesn't happen that way. And I mean, things like even Mulholland Drive, like Angelo writing the main theme for that film before they had even shot any principal production. It starts with the music. It doesn't start with the images, which I think is a big distinction from how things are mostly done these days, you know.
That's amazing. Dean, in terms of when you were put in that big room and told to work out how it worked, talk to me a little bit about how that journey kind of started for you, not in terms of, you know, starting to put your stamp on things and starting to collaborate with him, and how that was, I guess, what your perception of what that was going to be and the reality of it, really.
Yeah, like I said, when I started it, the job, the kind of listing was like studio engineer. So I went up there kind of a little sheepish, because I thought it was all going to be me, like with an EMI lab coat on, pressing record. But like in that first meeting, and the way he talked about the job, where he's like, you know, we do a lot of experimenting up here, and that's the room we do it in. It was like so open-ended of like, oh, this isn't just X job. This is like a whole thing. So starting out up there, yeah, my first job was, I mean, he's always been into music, but he was recording a lot of stuff on his own. And so my first job up there was working out and recording the song Ghost of Love for Inland Empire. So it was just kind of like I'm thrust in the seat I'm not really a music guy going into that job, but he definitely exploded the world of music in me. But I remember that first week when I found out I got the job and I knew it was going to involve music recording, I went to a musician friend of mine and I was like, tell me all you know about bars and beats. Like, I didn't even know what the grid in Pro Tools did because I was coming from sound effects world. And I was like, tell me about time signatures. Tell me about bars and beats, you know, and just in order to be able to do that. So, yeah, like going in there, recording Ghosts of Love the first week and, you know, watching all that just sort of happen and playing on it as well. That started the whole thing. And it just started expanding from there. It was like more and more jobs and more jobs. And I guess by the time of Twin Peaks, you know, the whole thing of like, it was always the thing that came out of his mouth of, do we have a large, scary orchestra choir? And that to me is like, no, we don't have that, you know, but like, I got to find it some way. So the digital realm and things, you know, are so easy. I would just manufacture these things and make them. And when I didn't have a scary choir, I would find tonalities and things and samplers to kind of get like things and to basically manufacture pieces like Laurie was doing with slowing down things to put in his bin to use. So that's how I kind of evolved to just like making stuff for him because it was all moving so fast. And it was always a desire. I need this. I need that. You know, just, he would just kind of like spout off like kind of like Tourette's. He would just kind of look at me and he would go, Alphorn. And like, you know, I was like, okay, Alphorn. And I would like look up online, like, what the fuck is an Alphorn? And you'd see this like, because I knew in my head, it's like Ricola. Like, that's all I knew. And so I'd look up Alphorn and then I would like, I'd find a sample, I'd throw it in a sampler and I'd map it out on a keyboard and I'd be like, Alphorn. And then he would like put his hands on, he's like, yeah, you know, and then that's how a piece would come out, you know.
Laurie, you're laughing there. It's a similar vibe.
Yeah, that is so funny. Unfortunately, we didn't really have internet when I was
yeah, I
getting some weird requests, but yeah, I mean, I think he sort of was led down a path that eventually made him believe that if he said Alphorn, he could have Alphorn like that. Yeah, when I was working with him, he knew that things took time. They had an espresso machine on the dubbing stage, and I had lived in Seattle, so I knew how to make an espresso. And everybody did everything for each other. David would answer the phones. It was kind of all these shared tasks. But anyway, we needed a big change, a big music change on one of the episodes. And I went up to my editing room, was working on it, and he came in and he said, Laurie, I'd really like an espresso right now. He said, okay, well, I want you to decide which is more important, getting all those people back to work that are waiting for me to fix this music, or should I stop and go make the espresso? He said, okay, let's fix the music first.
It encapsulates everything for me. That represents my job as well.
Yeah, because for him, it's like this, I need this just as much as I need this. And the solution was that I trained somebody else to make espresso the way that I did. And he was very good at it.
How did he feel about Twin Peaks?
It was really funny because I remember when we finished the last episode of season one and nothing had aired, of course. Nobody had any idea how anyone was going to react. And we were all just kind of moving forward each day, making this thing, and nobody had seen it or heard it. And so we finished and everybody's like looking at each other like, now what? And then he said something like, I don't know what anybody else thinks, but I like it. I think it's good. And of course, then, you know, the whole thing blew up.
Wild.
I always noticed in finishing a number of things with them, the bigger things like Twin Peaks, and there was a kind of a solemnness toward the very end where I thought and expected we would finish the last fix and then everybody would be turning to each other and high-fiving and popping champagne. But it was like a solemn thing where you get to the last fix and it's like, okay, you know, you kind of look back like that was the last one on the list. And he would kind of go, there's one time he was like this. He was like, okay, I guess we send it out now. And he just walked out of the room. Like there was almost like a thing of he didn't want to stop working on it. And it was a little bit sad that it was done.
Absolutely. I think the journey was the destination.
For sure.
Yeah.
I think that's the secret, the core to understanding him is that I think a lot of people who ingest this stuff and enjoy it see the result. But for him, it was about the experience, like moving through it and the excitement and the fascination with what happens when you do this, you know, being in the lab, so to speak. And I mean, he was obviously after a result, but for him, it was definitely more enjoyable to be actively working, you know, on it.
I experienced that as well. I witnessed that it was play for him. So when it was finished, it was almost like you're at your friend's house and a bunch of friends are over and your mom just pulled into the driveway to pick you up. Party's over. I mean, we had so much fun that had nothing to do with the work we were doing. We were just, you know, we would goof around and do silly things. And it was always fun. Every day was fun. And yeah, it was hard work and long hours. But, you know, there was always something either hilarious going on or just some fun play going on. Back when they had styrofoam cups for coffee and we were sitting behind the mixers and pushed his coffee cup over a little bit and this little bubble came up to the surface and sort of rolled around on the top of the cup. And he said, did you see that? And then he did it again. And so he just kept pushing the cup back and forth, making this little bubble roll around. And he was, you know, that was part of like his joy, discovering just silly things like that. And one time when we were mixing the main title, or the shot of the waterfall, and he kept making them go backwards. And he goes, I could just watch that water go up the waterfall all day. It was so sweet.
Now I feel like the mom who's come to pick the kids up from the party, because I can't believe the time already that it's been so joyful to spend time with you both. And just, I can't thank you enough for your beautiful and very personal insights into your time with David, working with him and collaborating with him. And yeah, I'm so grateful for your time today. And I just think it's wonderful that it's getting a new release and people can access it, you know, and kind of go back to the start and kind of see it through again. And that's just, it's the gift that keeps on giving in a way. And wonderful that new generations are discovering it and rediscovering it. So I can't thank you enough for today. Thanks so much, Laurie. Thanks, Dean.
You're welcome. Thank you, Edith. And thanks for what you're doing.
From the score to Twin Peaks, that's The Love Theme by Angelo Badalamenti, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with the wonderful Laurie Eschler and Dean Hurley.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go
big time
on a fancy water bottle
with ultra titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
My huge thanks, genuinely huge thanks to both of them for taking the time to talk to me. I just felt kind of empowered and enriched by our conversation. Both the original series and Twin Peaks The Return are available to stream on Mubi as of the 13th of June. And it really is. It's so wonderful to get the chance to go back and revisit it. I guess because we've lived a life as well, so you bring with it loads of your own experiences to rewatching it, so go and do it. If you're new to Soundtracking, you can find every single episode, there's over 500, at edithbowman.com, whilst we're at Soundtracking UK on your socials. It is a very busy time of it on Soundtracking, so I will be back on Friday with that conversation I mentioned at the start of the show with John McLean and Jack Loudon, who will be discussing John's much anticipated new film, Tornado, which I will just point out is going to be in cinemas as of the 13th. So, day of release, you'll hear John and Jack talking Tornado from our Everyman Soundtrack and Film Club. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
Messages.
Hey Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.